welcome to the teaching ministry of North Coast Church at Vista, California. We invite you to please open your Bibles as we join Pastor Chris Brown for today's message.
You are light years away from any cell phone reception, internet, pagers, phone calls. The entire beach is to yourself. There's enough of that little Pacific breeze just to cut the edge of the sun that's searing down on you. If you want to take that short little walk to the water's edge, you got to wear sandals because the sand's already heated up so much. Or you can do that little run until you can't take it anymore and then dig your feet in and until you're ready to get to the cool water. The ice in your little umbrella drink is already starting to melt in with whatever you want in your little umbrella drink. I'm not here to judge. It's nothing but the sound of waves just crashing up on the seashore. A bird every now and then, and you finally let everything that you've been running from just drift away. Can you go there? It's where I've been for the last week. It's why you have a blank note sheet in front of you. It started with some friends that we have that just said, man, if you could ever make it down here, make it down here. And I did, and I've just been doing this. I brought a book, even though I know in my heart I'm never going to read it. They just tell you you should bring a great book with you when you go to the beach. So I did. I brought Larry's newest one. Because I couldn't find any of my great books. It's now a cup holder for my umbrella drink. And we have some friends that are living down in Mexico that said, man, Chris, Amy, if you guys can ever make it down here, we got a spot for you. And I thought, man, with the economy that has taken a tank, with all the crime that you hear from Mexico, with the swine flu scare, this is the time to go. You're going to get great deals. It's going to be empty, and it was. You got to take opportunity when it comes. And so we just, several years ago, Amy and I said, look, we're going to take a week every year, just the two of us, leave the kids. It's good for us. We need to get away. And so let's find our way down there, get down to Mexico, stay with some friends. In fact, here's what we did basically 8 days straight, just hanging at the beach, enjoying each other, enjoying what God created. And it was sweet. So... oh, I don't know how that got in there. No, you can take that off. That was a mistake. And so all I ask, several months ago when we're planning this, we said, you know what? I don't ask for much around here. I really don't. I said, look, we're getting back Friday night. We're going to get home around midnight Friday. I just don't want to have to teach that Saturday and Sunday. And here I am. And Larry's schedule changed where there's some stuff he needed to be at. And he goes, Chris, I know you're just coming back. Can you do this? And I said, I will, but there's no way I'm working while I'm gone. So we're just going to do a blank note sheet. Whatever thoughts are on the plane ride home, we'll put it together. And I tell you, there were two major thoughts over this week away. Two thoughts that as the time the days rolled on that just became incredibly clear. Number one was this. And I'll say it because my kids are in the little kids class. They can't hear this. But... day two, three, four, we didn't miss them. They were in great hands here with some college sisters that are just living in our house, taking care of them. And pretty much we had one rule, just keep them alive. And other than that, we'll fix anything that happens. They did a phenomenal job with them. But basically we told our kids, keep the babysitters alive. And yet day five, six, seven rolls around. And you know how it is if you're a parent. And we're sitting on the beach, and all I could think about is, man, our kids would love to be playing in the sand right here. We found one of those resorts within driving distance that we couldn't afford to stay at, but you can go and crash for the day. And we're in their pool, and they got a water slide. And all I could think about is my kids would wear out this water slide. They would just be going up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down until they dehydrated. Every place we went, I'd be eating, oh, my kids would love this fish taco right now. And you just started missing kids. It's the heart of a great parent. when you're away, it's great to get away, but as those days start to linger, man, I miss my kids. Second thing I realized, the people we're staying with have a home, and when you walk out in their kitchen, dining room, and open up the drapes, all you see is it's the beach and the ocean, the little boats that are anchored out there. Just beautiful down there in Mexico. I love Mexico. And I remember that first day standing out there in the porch with my wife, my arm around her, and we looked at that scene and we thought, man, we could just stay here forever. If we never leave this porch, we'll be happy. This is an amazing view. Day two, eating breakfast, looking out, going, man, babe, you check out that view again. This is amazing. Day three, day four. By day five, day six, you're walking by the window. By day seven, you're not opening the drapes because you don't want the sun in. And something about that view that you could stay there and look forever. By day seven and eight, by the time you go home, you have to remind yourself, oh, wait, let's look at that view again before we go. And how easily something that we thought was so amazing just kind of wore off as you walk by it more often. You ever had that before? And both of those thoughts come crashing in on me on the way home. Both of those thoughts, as I've tried not to set my mind on teaching, but just on hanging with my wife, all come down to Luke chapter 15. And if you got a Bible, turn there, because I think both those thoughts are going to hit home. I know you haven't found it already because no one had any idea, including me, what passage we were going to be in. So Luke 15, New Testament, back of the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. Look for the guys' names, Luke 15. We're going to take on this entire chapter. Luke 15 comes to that place in time where Jesus has already taken 15 chapters, probably at this time a little over 2 years, maybe 2.5 years, of his public life and ministry, showing people his power after power after power, with miracle after miracle after miracle. At the same time, filled with this incredible compassion that he's not just about performance or putting on a great show, but he's about the heart of not crowds, but individuals. Taking time for the leper, taking time for the blind, taking time for the dad who has a 12-year-old who seems to be possessed, taking time for a bleeding woman who's been a social outcast or pariah. Person after person after person. Unmatched, unparalleled, unmitigated power and compassion. And we come to a place where he's starting to be questioned. You don't act like most teachers act. You don't do what most teachers do. And in Luke chapter 15, if you want to write in your Bible, you can just kind of call this the gospel of the gospel. Or if you don't like the big churchy word gospel, which is simply the good news, you could put the story of the whole story. It's what I got written above chapter 15 in my Bible. This chapter lets you know what this entire book is about. Not just the book of Luke, but the entire Bible is about. This is the chapter that gives you the heart of what God is about. And so I just kind of wrote in a note sheet before I left, not knowing where we go, that this is the blank you fill in. Have fun writing. I'm sure something will hit you. I'll try to give you some stuff at the end. But Luke 15, verse 1 starts like this. Now the tax collectors and the sinners were all gathering around to hear him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and even eats with them." You got tax collectors and sinners. You got tax collectors, people that profit out of their own people's demise. People that profit out of collecting money for the Roman government that is in power and ruling and oppressing your own people. In our society, people that make a profit off of the demise of their own people. Pretty much you can have pimps and drug dealers. I almost said tax collectors nowadays. IRS guys, no, totally different. Not talking about you. Pimps and drug dealers. And this is who's hanging out with Jesus. Pimps and drug dealers. Now remember, in this day and age, for someone who is following God and the Jewish religion, you were trying to do it to the utmost of the law. You were trying to keep yourself clean, and you had absolutely nothing to do with the unclean. It says that Jesus not only hangs out with them, but he also eats with him. Remember, in a Jewish culture, to break bread with someone, to sit down and share a meal with someone, is to have a friendship or relationship with someone. How in the world is this guy Jesus hanging out with people like that? And they mutter to themselves. And Jesus, knowing what they're thinking, just says, let me give you chapter 15. If you've ever wondered why God is doing what God is doing in your life, if you ever wondered what God thinks about you, if you've ever wondered what this book has to do with you, I think you're going to find the answer today in chapter 15. And then it comes down to two things. It's about a dad's heart that really, really misses his kids the longer they're gone. And it's about not forgetting to walk by some of the most amazing views. And once again, opening the drapes, maybe if these stories are familiar to you, and stopping once again and remembering how amazing this passage is. Because my bet, if you're like me in the Christian life, the longer you go, the more you just kind of take it for granted and pass on by. And Jesus says, let me give you the answer that you might be looking for. Three stories. Number one, Jesus told him a parable. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and he loses one of them. Does he not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders. And then he goes home. And then he calls his friends and neighbors together and says, rejoice with me. I have found my lost sheep. I tell you that in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent. Okay, a little foreign to us, because most of you aren't in the shepherding business. A little foreign to us, because most of you don't take care of sheep or have a lot of sheep in your portfolio at this time. It's not a huge investment. But remember, in the first century, in Jesus' life right now, as he's talking about something that every single person in the crowd knows about, because they firsthand have experience in shepherding or owning sheep, or secondly, they see on a daily basis. Your Palestine area, Judea, if you will, this area that you can actually have sheep in before you get down to the cliffs and the desert, is only roughly about 20, 30 miles wide, a stretch of maybe about 90 miles long. No matter where you go and travel, you see shepherds with sheep. It is just part of your existence. It's like Jesus using a story about cars today. You probably all own one, and if you don't, you've at least seen thousands of them. He says, let me tell you about sheep. You know that shepherd out there? So he's in charge of 100 of them. At the end of the day, he counts and he's got 99. What does he do? Everyone starts nodding their head. Oh, yeah, we know what he does. He sets off, doesn't he? He leaves the 99 that are safe and he sets off and he finds that one. And when he tracks it down and finally finds it, because sheep are stupid, the stupidest animal alive, they're foolish. If you've ever read up much or wonder why we're called sheep in the Bible, there's probably a good reason there. Everyone knew sheep, even if they get lost, they could hear the bleating of the other sheep and they would go the opposite direction. They're just dumb animals. Foolishly, one wanders off, and that shepherd will go until he finds it. When he finds it, he puts it on his shoulders, and he comes back rejoicing. He's not angry. He's not bitter at the sheep. He's not holding the grudge, stupid sheep, why'd you go off? Blah, blah, blah. He's rejoicing, because all these sheep were in his care, and now he's got them all back. And Jesus says, that's what God's like in heaven. Man, the moment somebody foolishly goes off and does what they want, God will search for them. And when he finally gets that person back, there's rejoicing. Doesn't quite do it for you, does it? Yeah, me neither, because I'm not big on sheep. He might realize at this point he's got some of the men's attention in the crowd, but he's just lost the women. So he gives them a little romance novel. It's a short one. But he speaks to the female hearers in the audience, verse 8. Or suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one, and their ears perk up, and they're like, oh, I got that. It could have just been she's got 10 little coins and she needs them for food that day. I mean, we're talking about an area that we would consider very impoverished. But more, I think he's talking about that little headpiece that women would wear. They would save and save, and their husbands would collect and put away a coin at a time until he got 10. And once you had 10, you would make a small hole in them, and you'd make a silver chain that goes around them. And then you would put it on the head of your wife, and she would wear that every time she was out in public. It was a sign of how much she was valued. It was her wedding ring, if you will. It was what she wore to everyone else to let them know, I am taken, I am loved, I am valued. In that day and time, those coins could not be traded, they could not be bartered for. No matter how much debt that woman or that family accrued, you could never take the headpiece of a woman to pay for a debt. It was her sign of value and worth. Always 10 coins, always with the silver band. And when Jesus says there's a woman who has 10 coins and loses one, I think every woman in the audience, oh, heaven forbid, what is she going to do? And I think he tugs at the romance of the women's, and he tugs at their heart, and he says this. So does she not light a lamp? Does she sweep the house? Does she search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and neighbors together and says, rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin. And in the same way I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. Now remember, at this day and time, we've got a dirt floor, an earthen beaten down floor in these little adobe houses, usually only lit by one window, anywhere from 12 to 18 inches wide. It's going to be dimly lit inside, even at noon hour. You drop a coin on a floor like that, that's going to be covered with thatch. Thatch that's laid across and then laid another way, and then usually with reeds put over it. To drop a small coin in the midst of something like that, you're talking about the proverbial needle in the haystack. You're talking about a woman that would probably take all the reeds out one by one and put them outside the house. Then she'd start picking up the thatch one by one and shaking them out. And when that was done, she would take the broom and she would start sweeping that dirt floor and find out, where did that coin go? And whether it was when the glimmer of the window light coming in, or whether it was just hearing it as the broom hit and it rolls across the floor, finally finding it, realizing when husband comes home, she wouldn't have this missing piece in her headband. And she'd call her friends that knew that she had lost that coin outside and run out of the house. I found it. And there's rejoicing. And he goes, that's what God is about. Whether somebody foolishly goes off and then finally comes back, there's rejoicing. Whether someone led not by themselves, but by someone else's choice or actions has been led astray and found, there's rejoicing. And yet we don't really get it, do we? Not much of us are into sheep nowadays. Most of us don't have headpieces of 10 coins. And so Jesus, realizing, I've got to let people know. What does God think about you? He says, let me tell you now a story about a dad that has two boys. And I think now everyone has their attention on Jesus. Because every one of you have been a child. A lot of you have had children. All of us have had a dad. Regardless of what type of example or model that dad was, all of us understand this relationship. And he goes, now let me tell you a story of a dysfunctional family and how God works and why I do what I do. The story is called The Prodigal Son, and yet I don't think you could come up with a worse name for this. This has nothing to do really with the prodigal son. It's a story of two sons, and yet the main character is really not the two sons. Jesus is telling the story to say, let me tell you what dad is like. Let me tell you what God is like. And on day 6, 7, and 8, and on a ride home and coming in late Friday night, my thoughts were centered basically on a passage that follows like this. And a view you might have once got, but missed. And so I want to take you back there. Luke 15, verse 11. So there was a man, and he had two sons. And the younger one said to his father, Father, give me my share of the estate. So he divided his property between them. And right now, there's a gasp in the crowd. Take that kid outside. Are you kidding me? Can you imagine the scene? Okay, you're in a day and age where Jesus set the scene of how it's going to be divided. There's not 13 sons that you have to divide inheritance. There's a dad, two sons. Everyone know in that day and age, the first son would get a double share. That was the privilege of being a firstborn in that day and age. The first son got a double share. So 2/3 to the oldest son, 1/3 to the youngest son. Now the youngest son gets up in dad's grill and says, Dad, I want my share now. One day you're going to die. I mean, you're getting old. You're going to croak and half of it's going to be mine. Why don't I have it now? Imagine the scene in your house. Imagine the scene in my house. West Texas coming in from, I don't know, riding dirt bikes or something like that and realizing, wow, one day dad dies. I'm going to get something. I'm going to ask for it now. Going up to pop and just saying, hey, dad, one day you're going to croak. I don't know where you're going to leave me, but I'd like to have it all now. Woo! I imagine my dad just glaring at me and going, I'm sorry. I don't recognize you. You're not my boy. You might want to get out of my house and off my property. And you might want to take those clothes off because I know I bought them. Go. No son of mine is ever going to speak to me like that. You're in a day and age where a dad can basically what we would call retire. A dad can remove himself from the family business. And while a dad is still alive, he can take the inheritance and he can divide it up amongst the boys as it should. That was a practice. Not very common, but it did happen. So dad did have the prerogative of saying, you can have your stuff now. No boy ever could go to dad and say, hey, I'm going to live my life as if you're dead now. Hand it over. And yet those words come out. But the part that the audience gasp at is Jesus saying the father said, so he divided his property and gave it to him. You beat that kid. Little punk, who is the right? He comes up and asks, what? No, this Father says you can live life as if I was dead. You can live life on your own. You can take what I've got for you and what I have in store for you and what I've made for you and what I've worked for, and you can have it all and you can do whatever you want with it. Now, this story, some of you might know. Others of you that might be new to Christianity or just checking out the last few months, this might be new to read it verse by verse. You're going to find a glimpse exactly what God is like and what Christianity is about. Remember, Jesus is talking to a crowd saying, why do you act like you do? And he's trying to say, let me tell you what God is about. Basically what Jesus is, the only Son of God. Let me tell you what God is about. This story comes firsthand from the only Son of God talking about God. So it's a pretty reliable source. Saying, let me tell you what Dad's like. Dad'll give you whatever you want. Dad'll give you life, make life, have a plan for you, and let you take life and do whatever you want with it. And as this story has a couple twists and turns, I got to come back and go, whoa, 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 Dad, you had to know what your kid was going to do with it. As parents, as your kids grow up, you have a pretty good idea of how they're going to handle responsibility. They show that in their character. This kid has already shown the type of character he has by coming up and demanding his life as if his dad is already dead. You got to know he's going to blow this money. And yet the dad says, that's what you want. Take it. It's called free will. Take it. I know you're going to blow it. I know you're going to squander it. I know you're going to spend it all on yourself. I know you're going to take this life and all I've given it, and you're going to use it on you. It's your choice. It's called free will. I know you're going to have the ability to hurt yourself, and you will. I know you're going to have the ability to hurt others. And some of you have, or been hurt by others. And yet God says, that's free will. I will give you life and let you use it however you want to use it, even though I know you're going to blow it. I go to the mall with my kids, even though they're small, and I give them each $10. I can tell you how they're going to spend it. I can tell you, one of mine's going to run right to the candy store and put it up and say, how much can it buy? That's what she's going to do. I can tell you the other one's going to shop and look and look and think, and she'll think about others or someone else, and some of you already nodding your head. You know your kids. How do you give your punk kid that kind of inheritance? And then he backs his old car up, puts the trunk, dad takes inheritance, puts it in the trunk, and the kid takes off. Dad probably watches until taillights break at the little corner of the intersection, the long dirt road, hangs a right, and it disappears out of sight, and all you can see is a little dust trail left. And the Bible takes us inside to his destination and what happens in verse 13. So it wasn't long after that. The younger son got together all that he had, and he set off for a distant country. And there he squandered his wealth in wild living. I like that. Wild living. I have no idea what that means, but all of us have a picture already what wild living is. Some of us have tamer pictures than others. Some of us rely on past experiences going, wild living, no, no. Squandered it, blew it. And it all started with that little phrase back in verse 12, Father, give me. If you haven't circled it or underlined it, that's where it all starts. Give me. Dad, give me. It's mine. I think I deserved it. I've earned it. I want to live life as if you're not around, as if you don't exist. Give me. It's the core of rebelliousness, that attitude that just says, give me. And now we find out what he's done with it. In 14, after he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to the fields to feed pigs. And he longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. In just a couple lines, it takes you into the depths of where this kid has sunk to, literally sunk to. See, with a trunk full of inheritance, you can go a long way. I'm sure that old car was traded in the first time he came to a new car lot. And back on the road with a new car with a trunk full of inheritance. I'm sure he put his pedal down on the floor and just made as fast as he could until on the horizon he saw the great pyramids and the skyscrapers of Vegas. That's where you go with a trunk full of inheritance. Because what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. And I'm sure in Vegas with a few phone calls, you can make a lot of friends when you got a trunk full of inheritance. And I'm sure there's all kinds of people that have your attention. And I'm sure you can make it for a while. Until the Bible says there is a huge economic downturn. A severe famine. Until times got tough. Until because money wasn't invested or invested wisely or thought it was invested wisely, just came back with big zeros, well, things started to get lean. And you know, when the trunk is empty, the friends don't seem to come around anymore. I'm sure he's made some acquaintances that gave him a place to stay every now and then. But after about a week or two, hey, buddy, I think we need our couch back. Yeah, you know, I talked with my wife and, she, you know, things just aren't working. Ah, man, I'm sorry, man, but we're going to have to ask you to leave. Oh, yeah, no problem. I got other places to go. To someone else's couch, and then as the door shut, to someone else's garage, to someone else's little back area, just living underneath the shelter, to finally wandering behind the casinos and finding whatever food from the buffet was thrown out, to seeing a man back up in a large truck and taking all the leftover food and slop, a little conversation start, and you find out he has a pig farm outside of town. Actually, if you're hurting that bad, I need someone to shovel this stuff to him. We'll give you a place to stay in the shed. The Bible says that's where he ends up. A Jewish kid shoveling days old leftover food to pigs. An animal in that culture seen as unclean. And this is now what he works with, walks with, smells like daily. Getting so bad that as he pushes food off the back of the truck into the slop bins, he sees some of the leftover crust from pizza and realizes it's probably still edible. It may taste like junk, but it'll fill your stomach. And now he even eats what's left for the pigs. I don't know how many months it's been. We're not given a timetable. I imagine it's not just been months, but maybe years. I imagine somewhere out there, he finally, what the Bible says in verse 17, when he came to his senses. Man, I got that underlined. When he came to his senses. When he has so many tracks in his left arm that you can't find a good vein anymore. When no matter how much he eats that's thrown out from the pigs, he can't gain weight. And he doesn't know if it's from the needles or the sexual activity, but he knows there's something in his body that's not right. The guy every now and then as he drops off food for the pigs asks if he's ever been checked and lets him know there's a free clinic, but he's afraid to know the answer. And when he came to his senses, when he realized what he has been given and what he did with it, when he got to a place where he thought, is this really all there is? When he got to a place, and guys, we come to our senses, not just when we're on the bottom of life, but many times at the top of life. When you come to failure or success, to a place where you look at what you've done the best with or the worst with, everything you've been given, and you finally stop and ask yourself, is this all there is? Is this what life is really about? Do I really just run this and then one day I die and I'm gone? I can't fathom being gone. But when this body dies, it's just over. And when he came to his senses, his thought went back home. And he said, how many of my father's hired men have food to spare? And here I am. I'm starving to death. I'm going to set out. I'm going to go back to my father and I'm going to say to him, man, what in the world am I going to say to him? You thought walking in the living room maybe 1, 2, 3 years ago and telling dad you want half of your inheritance? As if dad was dead, you thought that was big? How do you go back home after blowing it? How do you go back home after losing 35 pounds? How do you go back home with sunken cheeks? How do you go back home losing everything that you've had? What do you say to him? Hey, dad, I know you've worked hard for my brother and I and the family. I know you've spent your whole life trying to teach us what to do. And I asked for everything and Okay, Dad, I know I was foolish back then, and I know that I took and I'm sure there was day after day of feeding the pigs. He went through his mind, what in the world would I ever tell Pop? And there's no way I can get back in that living room and face him. But I can't spend the rest of my life here. And he comes up with this. I'll say to him, Father, I have sinned. That's good. Dad's a religious man. It's where you got to start. It's what I've done. Dad, I've sinned. I've sinned against heaven. I've sinned against you. I'm not even worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired men. So he got up and went to his father. From give me, two words slightly different. If they're not circled or underlined, make me. You might want to do that in your Bible. From a core of rebelliousness that says, give me, to now a place of brokenness that completely comes back and says, make me. Okay, Dad, I've blown it. Everything you've given me, I've blown it. I've done it my way, whether it's at the top of success or in the bottom of failure. I know there's got to be more. I've spent it on myself. Dad, I've blown it. I've sinned against heaven. I've sinned against you. I'm not even worthy to be called your son. I just want to be one of your slaves. You know, in the shed out back in the barn where we keep the hay, it has that little overhang. We store a lot of the equipment and stuff. I can just sleep there. Can you just let me crash there? I'll work this off. I know I can't really do it. I'll take the rest of my life. I'll just work on the farm, but at least I'll have something to eat. And I'll sleep out there and I'll just work with the hired men. I'm not even asking to be your boy. I'm not even asking ever to come back in the house. Can I just sleep out there? And I doubt if he's going to go for it, but it's me and the pigs. You don't give a 2 weeks notice when you're feeding slop to pigs. You just get up and start the long walk home. I don't know how many times he stood on the dirt road with his thumb in the air, watching truck after truck start to slow down until they get a good look at him, and then they speed up. Seeing in the eyes of every driver, yeah, I wouldn't stop for me either. Until a flatbed stops, and the guy says, hey, not in front, but you can ride in back. Let me know when you want to get off. And he jumps in the back with the bales of hay, and he starts the long journey home. Somewhere close to an intersection, he tops on the hood of the cab, and the driver stops. He doesn't have any bag to take with him. He just unloads himself. And he starts walking that long dirt driveway back to the ranch. The same one that he left taillights and dust years ago. And it's going through his head. Whew, here we go. Here we go. Okay, Dad, I'm not even trying to be a son. I've sinned. I've blown it. I've sinned against heaven and you. I just want to sleep out back and be a slave. Okay, Dad, I've blown it. I know I don't have anything to show for it. Can I just be one? And somewhere about three quarters of the way down that road, he hears the screen door almost kicked off its hinges. And he looks up and Dad starts making a beeline running. Jesus' audience that day is listening intently. They know this kid is going to get it. And they know he deserves it. And Jesus sets the scene from inside the house. While he was still a long way off, in the middle of verse 20, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son and threw his arms around him and kissed him. And once again, there's a gasp from the audience. Not in any good Jewish culture. Do you treat a father like that shamefully? You completely ruin the family's name. You squander everything on wild living. And you come back and you're greeted this way. A dad running when he sees him, yes. A dad that stops and says, don't set 1 foot closer, kid. This is not your home and you've blown it. You turn right back around. I don't care where you've come from, but you go back. Yeah. But a dad that runs and throws his hands up, not in clenched fists, but openly, just to grab a son and filled with compassion, there's a gasp in the first century audience. And the kid now has his head buried in his father's big chest. Dad's arms are wrapped around him, holding him tight, probably lifting him almost off his feet, just tippy toes. And he tries to get out the sentence that he's been practicing for weeks, if not months. And the son said to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven. I've sinned against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father cuts him off. He doesn't care about his words. He doesn't want his little speech. And he said to the servants, quick, bring the robe. And put it on him. Put a ring on his fingers and sandals on his feet. Bring a fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and let's celebrate. For the son of mine was dead, is now alive again. He was lost and he's now found. So they began to celebrate. And in a whirlwind of activity, the son is whisked back up to the home. A robe is called for to put on him. A ring is put back on his finger and there are sandals on his feet. A fattened calf is put on the barbecue because dad takes one look at what this kid has become, just a shell of what he used to be, and realizes you got to eat and you got to eat good. Some fatty stuff and we got a chunky lamb out there. He's going to be put on the spigots. And he's tried to get out. I'm not even wanting to go home. I just want to live out beyond the shed. I just want to slave. But dad has nothing to do with it. A robe, it's that symbol of honor. It's that symbol of status. It's that symbol of everything I have is yours. The family ring or crest, if you will, that's put back on his hand. It's basically the power of attorney. Whatever we have, whatever power we have, you now have the availability to make any choice or decision you want with it. It's immediately reinstated. Well, I know you've blown everything we've given you the first time around, but it's immediate. And I've missed this most of the time reading the story. Put sandals on his feet. In one of the very dark, horrific blights in our country's history of slavery, there was an old Negro spiritual that they would sing out. They would dream of the day when all God's chillens would have shoes on their feet. It was that symbol of a freed man. It was that symbol that set apart the slave from those that have rights and privilege to have sandals on your feet. You will never be a slave in this household, kid. Put some shoes on them. It's a sign of being a freed man. And the tiki torches start to be lit in the front yard. Folding tables are brought out. Everything that's in the house is starting to be put on the table. There's a fire racked up, and there's a fat calf that's starting to be barbecued. And the kid's got to be blown away. And Jesus says, do you get why I do what I do? Religious people, he says, you've completely missed how God sees you and how God sees them. And because of that, you've forgotten to stop and marvel at that view. There may have been a time in your life that you experienced it, but you've walked by it so many times. When's the last time you just stopped and opened the drapes and remembered how God sees you? This is Jesus saying, have you forgotten what the heart of heaven is? This is the heart of the gospel, the story, the good news. And then I love that next verse, meanwhile, verse 25. Don't you like the meanwhiles in our life? While God's doing some great stuff and stuff's going on, doesn't it seem like there's always a meanwhile going on? Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. And when he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him, What's going on? Dude, your brother's come home, he replied. Your father killed the fattened calf because it has him back, safe and sound. I got to go get some folding chairs from the garage. And he runs and gets them, comes back out. Meanwhile, the older son's been working in the field. Remember him? The one that didn't get his share of estate? The one that decided to stay with dad? The one that decided all these years to work for dad? The one that's decided to pick up probably an extra share of the load because little brother's no longer cutting his end of the deal. And he comes in from the field. He's been working. He's been slaving. He's been toiling. And he comes back. And as he gets close to the ranch, he sees the tiki torches, he hears the music, there's people dancing, there's a celebration, and he's running through his mind, it's not my birthday, it's not my dad's birthday, mom and dad's anniversary, what am I missing here? As one of the servants is running around to get more supplies, or probably those folding chairs we keep in the garage for extra company, he tells him, dude, your little brother's home, we're throwing a party. Really? Meanwhile. Really? And the older brother refused. Well, where did we leave off? 27. Oh, I did 27. We're going to read it again. I don't care. I took a week off. Your brother has come, he replied. Your father has killed a fattened calf, has him back safe and sound. You're right, 28. The older brother became angry, and he refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you. I've never disobeyed one of your orders, yet you never even gave me a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. And now, when this son of yours, you see what he calls his brother? Now when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes, he comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. Way to go, dad. Hypocrite. And now you're wondering why I'm not going to join in the dancing? Everything we've been taught to believe, everything you work for, everything this family stands for, this kid has gone against it. Everything that we've been told and forbidden not to do, this kid has jumped in and done. Everything that we worked to gain, to have life on, he has gone and blown it, spoiled it on himself and everything. Look at the bum. And you expect me to have a party for him. Thanks, but no thanks, Dad. Man, have you been there? One son comes home asking to be a slave. One son has stayed with father thinking he is a slave. All of my life, I've been slaving for you. I've never disobeyed your orders. And I've never been able to celebrate. Remember, Jesus is saying, I want to tell you what dad is like. And to do that, I got to show you how he deals with his kids. One kid goes off and blows it royally. But the moment he comes back, dad runs out to him. And celebrates. And everything is immediately restored. Here's the problem. There's always other kids that stay with dad, work for dad, slave for dad. All their life try to follow these rules. Jesus is now answering the heart of the two groups he's talked to. Those that realized I've blown it, God must hate me and want nothing to do with me. First son has answered your question. Now, those of you that are righteous enough that look down on others or point fingers at others, those of you that are spiritual enough where you're just slaving for God, where has it really gotten you? Well, I've never really been able to celebrate. And he says, see, both sons are stuck. And the dad that runs out the front door to the one is the dad that runs out the back door to the other. And simply answers him this way, my son, in verse 31, my son, the father said, you are always with me and everything I have is yours. In other words, who told you to be a slave to me? Well, Sunday school. Told me this book is a bunch of rules and I have to live up to them to please you. This book is a whole bunch of rules and I got to follow them all, and somewhere I'll get to a point where I guess heaven is celebration. But for now, where's the freedom that we have in Christ? For now, where's the celebration of being the Christian? And my fear is so many Christians see themselves as slave to rules. And it's a dad that runs out and said, who told you to be a slave? Everything I have is yours. You were never supposed to be working for me. You were supposed to be spending time with me. Who told you to be out in the field? I just thought it was my job. He said, your joy wasn't following rules. Your joy is pleasing me and working with me, and everything I have is yours. You can't earn that. You don't deserve that either. You'll never live up to it. It's yours. You haven't accepted the fact that everything God is yours. That those incredible views I stopped and looked at, I sat there on the beach with a rod in my hand and just thought, God, I have a great ocean. Because it's your ocean. And the Bible makes it clear I'm your boy. And I'm an heir to the throne. And God, this is our land. Thanks for letting me see a part of it I've never seen. This is cool. And it wasn't the view that I've gone by and missed. It was forgetting to stop and realize whose hand holds me in life. And realizing this is ours. And the way you think about me. And he says, but this son, we had to celebrate and be glad. Because this brother of yours was dead and is alive. He was lost and now he is found. And the crowd is sitting silently, rocked by a revelation they've never had before. In this day and age, God was someone you seek out. God was someone that you try to do all the rules to please. God is something that you must live up to. The Jewish culture in this day and age, before Jesus' teaching in the New Testament, did not have an understanding of a God that sought out sinners. Did not have an understanding of a God that said, I will go after foolish choices and foolish people. Did not have an understanding of a God that rejoices in his kids. Because after day 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, Dad really missed him. And Dad saw all that he created and thought, man, I wish my kids could enjoy this. Man, I wish my kids could be with me now. And the Jewish culture had no idea of a God that missed them. Their idea was working for a God that they had missed. And Jesus stops and gives us chapter 15. And says, whether you're led away by foolish choices, whether it was someone else's decisions or whatever that have lost you, whether you've just taken your life and blown it, in failure or success, you have a dad that misses you. And so please understand, he told the crowd, why I will hang out with all people. Because that's the heart of dad. Was there a point in time in your Christian life where you caught a glimpse of that? Was there a point in time where someone revealed to you how God missed you? How he will not, cannot ever take his eyes off of you? How in spite of who you are and what you've done and where you've been, you have a God that is deeply, passionately, and intimately in love with you? Was there a time you sat there and just thought, man, I could just be here forever? And if there is, and if you're like me, Christian life has gone on long enough where I've passed that view enough where I haven't stopped and realized how amazing it is. And yet maybe you're here today trying to figure out that fear of what God would ever do if you walked in front of him and how much he must be loading up judgment just to nail you. I hope chapter 15 has answered that question. The Jews had a statement that said, there will be joy in heaven over one sinner who is completely obliterated before God. And Jesus came and three times says, there will be joy in heaven for anyone who has blown their life who comes back to God.
You see the way he flipped it around?
Three things if you're a neurotic note taker and you don't feel like you're in church, in case you've written something down. Maybe the little arrows on the bottom. One, write down two words, give me. If you want to make it short, you can just put equals rebelliousness, or give me is the core of rebelliousness. Anytime our prayer life is, Dad, give me. Anytime we come to God and say, give me. Anytime we come to God and say, God, this is what I want, give me. Man, that seemed in the story to be the start of rebelliousness. But for number two, the next two words, make me, is the start of brokenness. Make me. God, in the midst of what's happening financially, I talk a lot about give me. But God, make me the type of man or woman that He wants you to be in the midst of this financial crisis. God, in the midst of this health scare, we have a lot of give me. But how many of us stop and say, but God, make me what you want to make me in the midst of this tragedy? In the midst of your relationship or marriage or the brokenness of marriage or the singleness that you carry with you. We always ask for give me. But how much of our prayer goes, but God, make me the type of man or woman you want to make me in the midst of this? That's the start of brokenness. Where we come to God and say, it's yours. Do whatever you want to do in the midst of it. And thirdly, God's love is accepted, not earned. God's love is accepted. It's not earned. It is not merited. It is not worked for. I love those three kids because they're mine. End of sentence. Not because of how they perform or what they do. Oh, I have more joy in my life when they're following what we want to follow and walking with me. That doesn't change the fact of how I love them. And if one of those three decide to grow up and say, I'm going to live my life as if you didn't exist, Dad. I'm going to take all that I've got and I'm going to leave home and pretend like none of your rules apply. They're allowed to do that. That's free will. And if they move to the Bay Area and get caught up in wild living and their friends ask them, hey, tell me about your family. And they say, oh, I never had a family. You know your dad? I never knew my dad. My dad was dead before I was born. Oh, that would hurt. But if you came and knocked at my door and asked about the one that was gone, I would tell you I still love him. That simply has to be accepted, folks. It's not earned. And I don't know what you thought about how God sees you today. But Jesus says, let me give you two things. One is, there is a God that desperately misses his children. And the further you've gone and the longer you're away, the more his heart must think, man, I wish they were just on this beach with me right now. Man, I wish they just knew my thoughts about them right now. And it's that view of God that as Christians, sometimes we just take for granted and keep walking past. And today I hope you stop and open the drapes and remember the way God sees you in spite of what you have earned and what you deserved. And if today you feel like a slave to God because you can't celebrate, then I ask that you stop working for Him and start simply practicing His presence in your life. And remember the way Dad sees you, not the way Jewish thought or a current myth of if God ever got a hold of you, man, He'd blast you. Not according to a son story. Father, may we not walk by that window without stopping and remembering your heart for us. Thanks for your love, for never taking your eyes off of us in spite of what we deserve and what we've earned, for mercy and grace. May today be a day that we learn to start practicing that presence in our life. I don't get it. I don't understand. But the small window of the heart of me being a dad gets a glimpse of you missing us and simply desiring to walk through life with us. May we find ourselves there in your name. Amen.
We hope you've enjoyed today's study from God's Word. Pastor Chris will return in a moment with some final comments. For more information, or if you'd like additional copies, please contact us at area code 760-724-6700. Our mailing address is North Coast Church, 1132 North Melrose Drive, Vista, California, 92083. Or visit our website at www.northcoastchurch.com. Now here's Pastor Chris.
As you go, I took a week off, so I don't have a closing. Next week, we'll start a new series. I'll see you then. Shake someone's hand. Get out of here.